It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. Haven't had any good naysayers yet, but we always put naysayers right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. I've covered a lot of elections in the last 4.5 decades. There are few elections that I can remember that made me as mad. Now, of course, November 3rd, 2020 with Trump, that made me mad because I think we got a fraudulent result. But the race involving incumbent Rhino Jamie Herrera Butler, who needs to be removed from the Congress, and the fight, which effectively comes down to Joe Kent and Heidi St. John. I've told you that she is a bald-faced liar, and she's lied in a number of ways, but also especially about saying, I will support whoever is the Trump-endorsed candidate, who happens to be Joe Kent. Of course, she made the promise when she thought she had the endorsement, and then she lied. I think she's also, and I would call it constructively lying, that there are independent expenditure groups, they're called dark money groups, that are allowed to spend money as long as they don't officially coordinate with the candidate, who are sending out flyers with Heidi St. John's picture and a picture of Donald Trump, which at least suggests visually that she has Trump's endorsement, which she does not. Now, I've told people, if somebody sent out the most complimentary flyer in the world with my face on it and somebody else's face on it and said, hey, look at this, Lars has got so-and-so's endorsement. If it wasn't true, I'd be the first one to call it out and say, I'm not going to take credit for something I don't own. Heidi St. John should do that. She has not. She does not deserve your vote. On that note, Joe Kent, retired Special Forces warrant officer and the Gold Star husband of fallen senior Navy chief Shannon Kent, joins me now. He's going to be the new member of Congress, I believe, from the 3rd Congressional District. Joe, welcome back.
Hey, Lars. Thanks for having me back.
So tell me what we should do to debunk these lies, because I spent an awful lot of my week off, which was with my wife and my granddaughter, took them on a trip, to northern Idaho. But I spent a lot of it answering emails from people saying, yeah, this Joe Kent, he's a Democrat. He's a Bernie bro. And besides, Trump backs Heidi St. John. I spent an awful lot of time answering emails from people with that kind of nonsense going on.
Well, I appreciate you helping set the record straight. I think what people need to just realize is that there's been $4 million, and they're still spending money right now as you and I speak. $4 million spent in the last 12 days to prop up Heidi St. John and really just to attack me and to spread these lies that she's the Trump-endorsed candidate, that I'm a secret socialist. The list goes on. They're basically taking the kitchen sink method, and they're saying, I'm either a secret Bernie Sanders socialist or the AP will run a hit piece on me saying that, you know, I'm a white supremacist and all the typical things conservatives get called. So people just need to seek out the truth on their own and realize that there's only one candidate right now that has a pathway to victory against Jamie Herrera Butler, who's endorsed by President Trump, who's been leading all the independent polls, and that's me. This mad rush to get Heidi St. John some additional polling numbers, that's just being done to take away from my lead to get Jamie Herrera Butler and Marie Glusenkamp Perez, the Democrat, into the general, so that our very conservative district then is forced to vote for Jamie simply because she has an R by her name. That's exactly what the establishment's trying to do. This is exactly what Heidi St. John and I, a year and a half ago, both agreed that whoever Trump endorsed, we would drop out and rally behind because of this exact scenario. But that's playing out because of, unfortunately, Heidi's ego.
Because, Joe, she's effectively being used as a stalking horse. The establishment Republicans want Jamie Herrera Butler in there. They've already got her number. They've already got control of her. And so they want to use Heidi to steal support from you. And that just lets Jamie sail into the final race in November, perhaps against Heidi St. John or perhaps against the Democrat. Although, does the Democrat candidate have much of a chance at all in the third?
Well, I think one of the big reasons they freaked out is because the most recent Trafalgar poll had the Democrat and Heidi St. John more or less tied, because Brent Henrich, who obviously, you know, we debated on your show, he dropped out and endorsed Marie. When you added the Democrats' numbers together, they were just almost tied with Jamie Herrera Butler. And that's when the establishment started coming in with all of this additional funding to prop up Heidi St. John, because they want to get Jamie and a Democrat into the primary, into the general, because then our district's conservative, people will just end up voting for Jamie. That's been Jamie's recipe for success this entire time. She's never been challenged on her Republican record. She's always had the luxury of running against someone like Carolyn Long or someone on the left. So I think the Democrats do actually have a chance because they have actually been able to coalesce around one candidate. So I think that's what's at stake right now.
So what are you gonna, and I had some people saying, well, why isn't Joe running more ads? And I said, well, because ads cost money. And I said, every candidate is spending every dime they've got. But like you said, there are a ton of ads being run both for Heidi St. John and Jamie Herrera Butler, because there's a lot of money there that wants one of those two, preferably JHB, to end up with the job.
Yeah, we're definitely running ads. We responded to it. If people go to my social media, they can find it. We just simply, I'm not taking any corporate PAC money. So we've raised a little bit over $2.5 million. That's all been on individual contributions from people in the district, patriots throughout the country. So we don't have the numbers to compete with them as far as fundraising goes. But what we have is we actually have grassroots support. I've done 220 town halls. I'll do one tonight at Climeline Park in Vancouver. And so we've just been out there knocking on doors as well. We've knocked on about 120,000 doors. So people can get a hold of me and they can hear my responses to all these silly attacks. And that's how we're going to beat these establishment super PACs.
You mean good old fashioned retail politics, actually knocking on somebody's door? And I mean that, I admire that. It's a lot better than a carefully crafted, you know, advertising campaign that puts somebody over the top.
Yeah, and I think people are going to respond to that, and I think they already have. I mean, the folks I go out there and I talk to in the district, they can understand authenticity when it's in front of them. Yeah, it's easy to get deceived by a mailer in your mailbox or a commercial or whatever, but right now I think people see that when the establishment coalesces around messaging, what that means. We've seen this over and over again. We saw it against President Trump. We saw it during COVID. We saw it in the election. So the election of 2020, this is the exact same thing right now. You can see which way the establishment wants to take this race, and so if people want to seek out the truth, and I believe they do, they can get a hold of me in some way, shape, or form, because I'm accessible and I look forward to engaging with them.
You know, the funny thing is, Joe, I had one guy say, well, I've heard he's a secret socialist. I said, do you think Donald Trump is stupid? And the guy says, no, I like Donald Trump. I said, do you think he endorsed a secret socialist? Do you think he really made that kind of, well, no. I said, then what does it tell you that Joe Kent got the nod from Donald Trump and Heidi St. John and Jamie Herrera Butler didn't? He goes, well, and I said, yeah, it tells you that it's just a fake attack. And I've been telling people, and I called her a liar today. I said, listen, you got plenty of liars in Washington, D.C. We don't need any more liars. And if somebody lies to you to run for an office, what do you think they're going to do to you as a constituent if they get the office? Just, you got to make sure that people know that. And I know you're doing it, but I want people to know it, because they'll say, well, gee, I didn't realize. Well, you got to pay attention to what's going on. By the way, Joe, thank you very much. Good luck. Climeline Park tonight. What time?
6 p.m.
6 p.m. And check out his website as well. And by the way, my endorsements, for whatever they're worth, you'll find them at LarsLarson.com, and I gave them earlier. Back in just a moment, we'll talk about whether or not the schools you send your kids to should secretly vaccinate them. And guess what happens when they do? Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to jump into the conversation, I'll get to phone calls here in just a moment. It's a Monday, and I'd be glad to invite you. If you're a naysayer, I'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Get a lot of naysayer emails that way. You can also vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Should the schools that you send your kids to and that you pay for, I got to remind you of that, you and the rest of the community pay for those public schools, should those schools secretly vaccinate your kids? Now, I think that most of you who listen to this show would say, well, absolutely not. That can't be happening, is it? Well, it has been happening, and you may not even know about it as a parent. The Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest school district in America, is now up against a lawsuit from a family. And listen to this, and imagine if you were sitting on the jury. A mother says her 13-year-old son was bribed to receive a COVID-19 vaccination at school without mom's consent. Maribel Duarte, who is suing the LAUSD, held the press conference a couple of days ago with her attorney to complain about the side effects that her son is currently suffering from the vaccine. And by the way, I know that some of you are vaccinated, some are not. It's your choice, or it should be your choice. Can you imagine this? Have you noticed how many young, healthy athletes have been just simply dropping dead? And of course, they are vaccinated. And you say, well, couldn't be the vaccine, could it? Look, we've been detailing this all the way back to the middle of last year when we told you about otherwise healthy people who were finally bullied or pressured into taking the vaccine. And then once they got the vaccine, just dropping dead from cardiomyopathy and other kinds of ailments. Well, Duarte says, this is painful for me because my son's health is not good. He's lacking the rest. He doesn't sleep well. He doesn't exercise the way he did. He's not normal to me. Duarte says her son has had bleeding disorders and asthma since he was a child. Doctors recommended against him getting the COVID-19 vaccine. She said her son's condition got worse after he got the vaccine. He got breathing difficulties and other symptoms like depression and anxiety. And all of this happened without the school's initial consent. California state law prohibits minors between the ages of 12 and 17 from getting vaccinations other than those required by law without the consent of a parent or a guardian. The 13-year-old attends Barack Obama Global Preparatory Academy, which is under the jurisdiction of the LA Unified School District. So now mom is suing. Now, can you imagine what would happen? And before you say right off the bat, well, I know my kids haven't been vaccinated. Have you actually sat down and talked to them and said, did the school talk you into doing this without my consent, without dad's consent or mom's consent or both? Find out, because if the school talked your kid into getting the vaccination, they also realized the potential hazard of letting mom and dad know what was going on. And where, I just wonder, where do you find people who work at a government-operated school, a public school, and take a government paycheck, who think they have authority that can supersede the authority of parents to make medical decisions, life-changing medical decisions for their kids? Let's go to Dave. Hey, Dave, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Earlier, you were talking with somebody about windmills. I wanted to add a different perspective.
Sure. The gentleman, just for everybody else who might not have heard that, the gentleman called and said, why do I see some of these electricity generating windmills and they're not turning? And the two things I know of are, one, most of the windmills are engineered for a 9 mile an hour sustained wind speed. So if you're not at 9, many of the windmills don't operate below a 9 mile an hour sustained speed. The second would be if there's a marketplace for the power, because power is generated a lot of different ways, and it may be that the windmill power is more expensive or has other questions. But I think the primary reason is there ain't enough wind. But what's your perspective?
Well, there's a YouTube video, or on the homepage of cctruth.org, there's a link called How to Ruin an Electric Grid in 3 Easy Steps. Not sure if you've ever seen it, Joe.
I have not. Why don't you describe it for the audience, because most of them probably haven't seen it either.
Joe Nova, who lives with her husband and child down in Australia, describes how Australia already tried to do what the UN wanted to do. They blew up their coal-fired power plants, put in solar panels on everybody's homes and all this free power, you know, in windmills and stuff. And all they had was rolling blackouts.
Yep.
And the
yep.
people in the country, they ended up buying diesel generators because they couldn't handle the grid switching, and that negated all their effects anyway.
And that's the reason. But you don't have Dave, I'm with you, because windmills could contribute to a power system. But when they're seen by the folks in charge, and Joe Biden and his Democrat friends in the Congress want to have us do the Green New Deal, where we get rid of fossil-fueled electricity. Well, whether you like it or not, fossil-fueled electricity is almost 60% of the entire grid, and wind and solar are about 7 or 8%. So if you say, we're going to replace the stuff that produces 60% of our electricity with something that's only generating 6 or 7 or 8% of our electricity, and it's a source of power, in the case of solar panels, that can't generate power two-thirds of the day because it's
right.
dark. And, you know, so you generally get an average of 8 hours a day. That's January through December, because obviously in the summer you get more sun and in the wintertime you get less, but the average is about 8 hours a day. So you've got an energy source that delivers one third of the day. And then the wind, strangely enough, the wind blows about one third of the day. I mean, it may blow more in some parts of the world or some parts of America and less in other parts, but it's generally, you know, it blows about one third of the day. So how do you supply a modern country like ours with electricity with two new sources that only generate power one third of the time? Dave, thanks for the call. Let's go to Will, who's a naysayer. Hey, Will, since we're close to the break, we've got a couple of minutes. What do you and I disagree about?
Yeah, the last segment with Joe Kent, you spent the entire time worrying about people might not know that Trump didn't pick Joe Kent. Why not worry about, like...
No, he did pick Joe Kent.
Yeah, right. Why does that even matter? Shouldn't, like the views and the ideas that, you know, someone has is more important than loyalty?
We've talked with Joe Kent about his views and ideas on, I don't know, a couple of dozen different subjects, but... In many cases, people will say, well, what kind of Republican is he? Well, he got Donald Trump's endorsement. That speaks
right.
Volumes.
Why care
right?
about that? What, Trump's not even in office anymore. Who cares?
Who would you say is the single most powerful political figure in America today?
I would say probably on Republican side or just in general?
Just in general. Overall, who's the single most powerful political voice in America?
I would say Trump, but he's going to lose to DeSantis. So.
No, but you just answered the question then, Will. If you say
no,
whether
no.
he's in office or has a title or draws a paycheck, if he is the single most powerful political voice in the country, and then a candidate is running for office and gets his endorsement, it's got to mean a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course it does, and I think it's kind of gross. I mean, you used to make fun
Why
of
Why is it gross?
Worship. You used to make fun of people that, like Obama, didn't want to criticize him. And now here you are, like,
I don't worship Donald Trump, and I certainly don't worship B. Hussein Obama, but I don't worship Trump. I just, I really think he does a great job, and I think a lot of people admire him. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and of course, it is an election year, even though we really won't get rolling in earnest until after Labor Day. But obviously, a lot of people are paying a lot of attention to politics right now. And you're seeing various different efforts. We talked earlier about Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan, which is less, I think, about projecting American power than it is about protecting Nancy Pelosi from her constituents in San Francisco, many of whom are Asian Americans. And then you look at other efforts like Joe Biden, who we just learned is going to make some kind of statement to the nation tonight because he claims that he has hit an Al-Qaeda target of some significance. We'll find out more about that a bit later. Phil Kirpin joins me now. He's the president of American Commitment. I want to get Phil's take on where politics is taking policy as all these folks try to either preserve their political future or maybe even improve their situation. Phil, how are you?
I'm pretty good, Lars. How are you?
Not too bad. So tell me about this. You write that there are a lot of ingredients in the 2010 Republican electoral landslide, but the most significant was raiding hundreds of billions of dollars from Medicare to pay for Obamacare. The Democrats gave the Medicare Cuts Club that they had used to beat the Republicans over the head for decades to their opponents, who then hammered away at them. Now, 12 years later, they may be trying to do the very same thing again. Can you describe what they're up to?
Yeah, well, there are two big sources of funding for this big mansion spending bill. One of them is the business tax. The other one is cutting Medicare prescription drug spending. And they keep phrasing it, with positive spin. They're calling it negotiation. They're calling it pricing reform. They've got all these different euphemisms for it. But fundamentally, what they're doing is taking almost $300 billion out of Medicare prescription drug spending to spend it on, you know, Green New Deal subsidies to wind and solar and Obamacare subsidies to the big insurance companies. And so it's largely a replay of what they did in 2010 when they used Medicare as a piggy bank. And their political hopes are pinned on this idea that they can convince seniors that somehow Medicare spending $300 billion less on prescription drugs will not hurt them. And I don't think Most people believe that. I mean, most people have too much common sense to think you're going to get the same number of drugs, the same new drugs, the same access to drugs if you siphon $300 billion out of the Medicare prescription drug program.
But they've got to find a win somewhere. And so far, Build Back Broke and some of these ideas aren't going anywhere. So they're going to just sort of raid the cupboard and say, we'll take the money out of here, but no, it's not going to hurt grandma. I mean, who buys that kind of argument?
Well, the media. The media does. You know, I've already been politifacted. They said it was false when I said that you can't take $300 billion out of Medicare without hurting seniors. They said totally false. I was like, okay, guys.
How do they figure it's false? No, but Phil, are they saying, oh, we just found out we can get a smoking good deal on all the usual pharmaceuticals that either keep people alive or make their lives better, and if we just don't spend the money, we'll still get the same result for all those Americans who are on Medicare?
They've got a very dirty trick because it is a price control. It is the government just forcibly lowering prices, taking the money out to spend on something else. But instead of just saying the Secretary of HHS will set the price, what they do is they say the Secretary of HHS will negotiate with the manufacturer, and if the manufacturer doesn't like the price that the Secretary wants, if they can't come to an agreement in the negotiation, they'll be taxed 95% of their total gross sales of that product, and the 95% excise tax cannot be deducted for corporate income tax purposes. In other words, they'll tax you out of business if you don't go along with the price that the Secretary wants. And then you might say, okay, well, what's the point of having this charade, of having this exercise of a fake negotiation where a company has no choice but to go along with it or else they get hammered, you know, into oblivion by this tax? And the whole point of it is to create this fake political talking point to say, oh, we're just doing a negotiation. It's not a price. It's a negotiation.
Well, it's negotiating.
And then the word negotiation polls at like 80%. People are like, oh, that's great.
Phil, I could buy your house for $10 if I could negotiate with a gun to your temple. I mean, that's what
correct.
It sounds like.
Which is what this is. So they're really just forcibly taking the money out of Medicare prescription drug spending. And, you know, you're going to get a lot fewer new drugs as a consequence of that. It's going to come directly out of that industry, which, you know, a lot of people hate that industry right now for some pretty good reasons. So they're a good political punching bag. But the fact is, if you take that much money out of Medicare prescription drug spending, you're going to have a lot less new drugs. And in particular, they've carved out the biotech drugs in this. And so it's traditional small molecule drugs, which means you're really going to, really what you're going to hit the hardest in terms of the research funding from this is Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, other diseases of the brain, because the biotech drugs, they typically are too large to cross the blood-brain barrier. And so this is really going to be a major setback for those in particular. So you would assume the seniors groups have got to be totally against this, and they're not. They're actually for it. AARP is out there leading the charge in favor of this because, as we've talked about before on your show, Lars, they get $750 million every single year from UnitedHealthcare, and UnitedHealthcare's got their hand out for the Obamacare subsidies that this is funding in the bill.
Well, see, Phil, I've got a little dog in the fight because I've been all about AMAC, which is a different group than AARP, so I'll admit I have a dog in the fight. But one of the reasons I've hated AARP, and I despise that group, is that they're one of the groups that pushed Obamacare across the finish line. You know, they helped to get it passed.
For the same reason,
they made money on it, right?
Yep. Look, so, I mean, just the numbers are so staggering. $750 million every year they make from UnitedHealth. I mean, it's like triple what they make in membership.
Well, if you get that amount of scratch from any one customer, if you think about a business that, like you said, they make more money from UnitedHealthcare than they do from their own members. So do they necessarily have to? No, they advocate for whoever's money is the greenest, right?
Yeah, so it's remarkable. They've been doing like press conferences every day demanding that this bill be passed that directly siphons money out of Medicare prescription drug spending, nearly $300 billion. I mean, seniors groups should be going nuts about this. I think it's going to be really, really harmful. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, price controls always cause shortages, right? But when yep. the price control is of gasoline or whatever, people see the shortage, they see the long line, they're angry about it. When the price control causes some Alzheimer's drug or some Parkinson's drug not to exist, people don't even know what could have been. So they don't even know that they should be angry. That's why it's so dangerous, because once we go down this path, this is going to be their go-to piggy bank for everything they want. They're just going to ratchet down the price controls, expand them to more and more drugs, and people won't really know what we've lost out on.
Well, isn't there a reason that the United States is still on the cutting edge for a lot of the drug research? Because the European countries have done exactly this. They go to the big drug companies and say, sell to us at this price or you won't sell at all. And so many of them have said, fine, then we won't. What happens when American drug companies just pull up stakes and say, we're going somewhere else? I mean, because research and production can be done almost anywhere on the planet, can't it?
Of course. And, you know, what we typically see in these countries where the government sets the prices is the best new drugs, the really cutting-edge stuff, is not available for years. And then eventually, when the drug company has made the big money in the U.S. or wherever they've been able to, they say, okay, now we'll sell at the lower price, you know, towards the end of our patent life. And so they don't get drugs until much later. And we have this in the U.S. also in the VA system where they've got a restrictive formulary. And so we know there will not be the same access to new medicines. And they've got some language in this bill that tries to prevent it from happening, but I think it's going to be impossible to prevent that. There's going to be some super major blockbuster breakthrough drug that's just going to say, we're not selling to Medicare. If you want it, you have to pay out of pocket, because the economics aren't going to make sense to risk being subjected to the price control.
But by the time that happens, what will you say? Well, that's a decision you made that was made for you 5 years or 10 years ago. And sorry about that, but there's nothing we and all that'll happen is consumer groups will stage a lot of press conferences and whine a lot, but they won't actually get anything done. That's Phil Kirpin, the president of American Commitment. We'll be back in a moment. I'll be glad to get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls and glad to represent the Pacific Northwest on the Radio Northwest Network. This segment of the show brought to you by Valhalla Tea Company. It's made by veterans to help veterans by donating $1 from every bag sold at ValhallaTea.com. That's ValhallaTea.com. First naysayer this week, is it Colin or Colin? I don't know which.
Oh, it's Colin, Lars.
Colon. Okay. So what's on your mind and what do you and I disagree about today?
I wanted to talk to you about transgender rights, if that's okay.
Sure. What do you mean by transgender rights? What right does somebody have to say that if they want to present themselves as a man or a woman or neither, that's up to them. They have no right to tell the rest of us how we have to regard them, do they?
Well, wouldn't you address me as sir if I asked you?
Well, I did address you as Colin. I might say, hey, sir, what do you say? And you, if you say, I'm not a sir, I'm a ma'am. Well, that's happened before from time to time. And I try to be polite to people. But if somebody says, I'm going to be a man and I'm going to wear women's clothing and I want other people to address me that way, and if you don't, I'll find ways to punish you. I'll get you fired. I'll get you canceled, you know, at whatever job you work at. I think that's out of line. You can be whatever you want. If you told me you are the reincarnation of Napoleon Bonaparte, I'm still not going to call you a general. How about that?
I agree with you. I think that if somebody comes at you and says, well, I'm going to come at you for not addressing me, I disagree with that, actually.
Well, you know that's you know that's happening, right? There are people who are getting disciplined and fired.
I don't think they should be doing that. People should be peaceful, and people shouldn't be. And I understand that, you know what, transgender people might be frustrated, and they might be angry, and they might be
mentally ill. Is that a possibility?
Mental illness is a big discussion to have.
Okay. Well, then we won't disagree there. Then tell me what we disagree. No, but you identified yourself as a naysayer. What do we disagree about?
I think we disagree on how to treat transgender people.
How so?
You want to be polite and kind and address them as his or her. And I honestly think that's how we should treat everybody.
Well, the only time that becomes problematic, Colin, if somebody calls in, and says, you know, to the producers, my name is Susie, you know, but Susie has a voice like this. I'm not going to say, well, you sound like somebody who's transgender. You're really a guy, unless that's what we're talking about on the subject. But you realize the radio show is not a good place to judge that. Where you judge it is at work. because that's the place where most of us connect with strangers we don't know, not members of our family. So at work, if somebody says, I'm really a guy, but I wear women's clothing and I want to be called by a woman's name and I want to be referred to as her instead of him, and then people accidentally refer to them otherwise, should the person who has decided to be transgender, because it's a decision. So if they decide to do that, should they be able to take legal action against the other person and get them fired or disciplined?
A person who is trans should also be patient and understanding that they're part of.
Do you think they are right now?
No. Well, no. Look, people who
I
are
don't either.
Angry are angry. People who are angry, and you know what? People who are, you judge somebody who is angry by the actions that they take.
But why are they? Can you tell me, since you brought that up, why are they angry? In other words, if you say this is who I am now, if somebody called me a full on progressive left leaning liberal. I'd probably laugh about it. I'd say, well, I'm not, but okay, believe what you want. But there is a weird difference between conservatives and Republicans. Try to call or conservatives and liberals, because if you call a liberal, they get all angry. You call most of us who are conservative, if you said you're one of those conservatives, or even if you said it in a disgusted tone of voice, I'd say, you're damn right I am, all day long and twice on Sunday. But try to call a progressive or a liberal, and they get all bent out of shape. So
here's my follow-up question, if that's okay.
All right.
My last follow-up question. Would you laugh at someone who had a mental disorder?
No. Why would I? I mean, now, I'll tell you what, Colin. If they start to insist, I mean, if I'm interacting with somebody, you know, and I guess I'd have to pick the situation. You know, if I walked into a restaurant and said, excuse me, ma'am, where can I sit? Where can my family and I sit down and have dinner? And it's a woman who's decided to present herself as a man. So I'm not a woman. I'm a man. I might chuckle a little bit and say, well, OK, I couldn't tell, you know, but other than that, no, I don't care to laugh at people, especially people with mental illness.
Lars, I really appreciate you, and I really love your show. Thank you so much.
I'm glad for that. How about that? The most agreeable naysayer I've had in a long time. Colin, thank you. And that's why I ask you, whether it's like Colin Powell, or is it like Colin, Colin Powell or Colin Jost?
I won't say my last name, but it's Colin from Oregon.
Colin from Oregon. Very good. I appreciate it. Let's go to Franco. Hey, Franco, what do you say about Nancy Pelosi and her trip to Taiwan? And thanks for listening.
Yeah, hi, Lars. Well, I tell you, I've been a Democrat for years because in Washington, all the way back to your ancestors, you know, we were hard workers, and being in unions, that's what it was. But once you find out what they were, I haven't voted in the last number of years for Democrats. Anyway, I think that if she wants to go there, she should go there, and we should have the best fighter jets escorting her because they have no right telling us we can't go.
I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you, Franco. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls. There appears to be some good news tonight. Word has come down that Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was involved in planning the 9/11 attack, has been taken out by American military. We're expecting to hear from the president of the United States later on this evening. I guess you can call Joe that. If he's not sick with COVID a second time, if he's not disabled by his own mental difficulties, but he's expecting to address the nation at some point tonight. We'll carry that live if we get the opportunity. But first, welcome to the program. Glad to have you on board for some honestly provocative talk for America. And if you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, you're certainly welcome. 866-HEY-LARS. Easy to remember the number. Naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And I'll get to our Twitter poll in just a moment. Brand new question from the news of the day. We put one up every day, and we put it in two places, so you don't have to go to Twitter if you really don't want to. And I'm going to be talking about the impact of what Joe Biden is trying to sell to America as the Inflation Reduction Act. And if you can figure out this backwards logic, Joe Biden plans to reduce inflation by doing the one thing the government does that drives inflation and makes it worse. So if you can follow Joe Biden logic, you know, there's got to be a whole science to Joe Biden logic to say, yeah, what are you going to do about inflation? I'm going to do the thing that makes inflation worse, and it's supposed to cure inflation. Anyway, I'll get into the details of that in just a moment. First, though, let me tell you what's coming up this hour. Joe Biden wants to hire almost 87,000 additional IRS agents. What could possibly go wrong? But there are less than 1,000 billionaires in the United States. So is it really about auditing the big guys, or is it about going after mom and pop out there? I think it's more about mom and pop. Democrat Mayor Muriel Bowser proclaims Washington, D.C. is a sanctuary state until all the illegal aliens started showing up on buses because Texas had to send them somewhere. So what changed? How did she go from sanctuary state to we need the National Guard to get a handle on all these illegal aliens? What myths about abortions have been developed since the overturn of Roe v. Wade when the decision-making went back to the states? We're going to dig into that. And take a moment to cast a vote in my Twitter poll. You'll find it, as I said, two places, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter and LarsLarson.com on the web. The question, should America support Taiwan's independence from the Chinese communists? I would say yes to that. I've got a bit of the dog in the fight. I was born in Taiwan because my parents were in the U.S. military, so I was there for the first 14 months of my life. I've also given you this. No, we should kowtow to China as your second choice. The White House Coordinator for Strategic Communications at the National Security Council, John Kirby, has again stated the U.S. government's policy, saying, we have repeatedly said we oppose unilateral changes. We have said we do not support Taiwan independence. And we have said that we expect to have any differences between Taiwan and mainland China to be resolved by peaceful means. We have communicated this directly. Well, this is the kind of weird stuff we've got going on in our government anyway. When China says, we are just one big happy family over here. We're mainland China, we're Hong Kong, and we're Taiwan. Taiwan is part of mainland China. It's not. Taiwan is its own country. As I said, I have a dog in the fight. I'd be the first to admit that. But for China to say Taiwan is part of our country, is it is not a self-determining country with its own government, with its own president, with its own industry, and with freedom for its people. That's called the Republic of China, not the People's Republic. The People's Republic is the Chi-Com version on the mainland. And then the U.S. government plays along with this, the One China policy, and says, oh, of course, Taiwan is just another neighborhood of mainland China, except for one thing. You know, when John Kirby says we do not support Taiwan's independence, consider this. Going all the way back to about 1979, we have been selling or authorizing the sale of weapons to Taiwan. And I don't mean pistols and rifles. I mean some serious military hardware, which requires the sign-off of the U.S. government. So on one hand, we're saying Taiwan is not independent and we don't support Taiwan's independence. On the other hand, we're going to sell them weapons to protect themselves against who? Against mainland China. Now, if that makes sense to you, you could probably qualify for a job at the Joe Biden State Department. It doesn't make any sense to me. I think Taiwan is its own country, has its own government, and deserves its independence from China, and they will fight for it. And we have given them the weapons to fight for it. If you take the, and this just occurred to me, but so, you know, forgive me for being a bit slow. But if you take John Kirby and Joe Biden at their word, we do not support Taiwan's independence. Okay. But you sold them weapons. So when you sold them weapons, because you don't support Taiwan as its own independent country, you were selling weapons to mainland China. Does that make any sense? Because that one doesn't make sense to me either, that you would say they're not their own country, but we sell them weapons. So when we sell them weapons, we're actually selling to Joe Biden's buddies in Beijing. Because as we all know, but we have to remind you of it, Joe Biden is owned lock, stock, and barrel by his Chi-Com masters in Beijing. And why? Well, because he allowed his son to go and peddle influence for years when Joe Biden was vice president, received millions of dollars with a percentage held aside for the big guy, Joe Biden, out of those deals. And as a result, his masters in Beijing have told him, jump, and all he has to say is, how high? By the way, I've got a couple of other things I want. Now, I want to get into this business about the Inflation Reduction Act. Consider this. Middle-class tax hikes are part of it. Increased prices are part of it. Slow growth, fewer jobs. That's what Joe Biden and the Democrats have planned when they call the Inflation Reduction Act that they want to pass. The Joint Committee on Taxation reports the bill breaks Biden's promise. Remember, and we've run the sound bites for you dozens of times, nobody's going to pay any more taxes if you make less than $400,000 a year. Well, the Joint Committee on Taxation, that's both Republicans and Democrats, say the Biden Inflation Act is going to raise taxes on Americans making as little as $30,000 a year and over half of the entire new tax burden by next year would be paid by Americans who make less than $400,000 a year. And by the way, if you look at the Tax Foundation's report, the Democrats' tax, the book tax, is going to shrink the economy and destroy 27,000 jobs. And that tax would also crush American manufacturers. It will lower economic growth by about $68 billion, kill 218,000 jobs, shrink worker wages by $17 billion just next year alone. But Joe promises it'll reduce inflation. Yeah, by what? Crushing the economy? Is that the way we want to go about it? In any case, welcome to the show. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Coming up, since the Supreme Court leak about Roe v. Wade hit the press, there have been a lot of claims about what overturning Roe was going to do. We'll talk about those myths coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to your opportunity to sound off to the whole United States of America. If you'd like to join the conversation, you're always welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers always go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Well, true to form, when the Democrats realized, and they should have realized this a long time ago, that Roe v. Wade, which was a terribly fraught decision, 50 years ago, that has already taken almost 70 million lives, when they realized it was going to be overturned and that the decision was going to go back to the state level, they began inventing, I think, a lot of mythology about abortion that deserves to be debunked so you can really understand what's going on. Well, Virginia Allen is a senior news producer and a podcast host at the Daily Signal and co-host of the Daily Signal podcast. Virginia, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You've looked into some of this mythology that's grown up, and some of it you can measure with public opinion polls. Would you mind sharing some of that with my audience?
Sure. You know, it's fascinating to see what the left has done in the wake of Roe v. Wade being overturned. And really what we've seen is a strategic fear-mongering campaign that the left is coming up with all of these things that are going to happen in a post-Roe world. And I think some of the biggest issues we've seen around medical topics, a lot of fear is being spread around, you know, women facing an ectopic pregnancy that they won't receive the medical care that they need, or women having a miscarriage won't receive the medical care that they need. And you know, it goes down the line to guns have more rights than women, all of these things. And so in the wake of Roe v. Wade being overturned, if you look at Google and what people were searching on June 24th, June 25th, the 26th, right after Roe v. Wade was overturned, people were asking all of these questions. They wanted factual information. They wanted to know what was going to happen regarding abortion in their state and across the nation. And the left responded to that with a lot of, in my opinion, what is largely propaganda.
Well, and can you give us some examples of some of that? Because to a large extent, nothing happened after the decision other than a few states made the decision or had already made the decision. Correct me if I'm wrong. because the people's representatives in those states, the folks who are supposed to write the laws, had said if Roe ever becomes a state decision, this is what we want the law to be in our state, which I think is in keeping with the system of government that we have. So, but other than that, nothing much changed except that for some states, abortions went down because they had trigger laws that said if we take it out of the federal hands, where it shouldn't have been to begin with, and we put it back in the hands of states, states are going to put limits on it. Nothing wrong with that, is there?
Right. That's right. There's about 26 states that have laws in place already to protect life. There's 13 states that pretty much have banned abortion completely, that are protecting life completely. And we're seeing that more states are taking the opportunity to protect life from the moment of conception, and certainly when that heart starts beating before 6 weeks. I want to begin by just talking a little bit about and sort of breaking down the medical aspect. You know, I'm not a medical professional, so when you hear people say that now that some states have restrictions on abortion, that women won't be able to receive the medical care that they need in the case of an ectopic pregnancy or in the case of a miscarriage, I was really curious to find out, okay, what does this actually mean? And so I began looking at some of the data and the research, and I spoke with Christina Francis. She's a board-certified OBGYN, and she's the CEO-elect of the American Association for Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And she told me that she's been in the field of OBGYN for years, and she said, in her opinion, she's never seen a physician who had good training in the field of obstetrics and gynecology that would consider an ectopic pregnancy or a miscarriage as an abortion, that they're completely different, and that anyone with medical training recognizes that the purpose of an abortion is to end the life of a child, whereas the purpose of, a medical procedure in the case of an ectopic pregnancy or a miscarriage is to save and preserve the life of the mom. And sadly, in the case of an ectopic pregnancy, there's nothing that can be done to save that unborn child. That life is lost. And many times that's also the exact situation in the case of a miscarriage. And so we have to consider intent and what is the intent of that procedure going forward. As I spoke with this pro-life gynecologist, he said, it really is truly just fear-mongering to say that women wouldn't be able to receive the kind of care that they needed, because for anyone who's a medical professional, they would be able to right away know that, okay, this is a medical emergency and we need to act.
I mean, I suppose, Virginia, I could imagine in some extreme case where a woman seeks treatment for an ectopic pregnancy, a pregnancy within the fallopian tubes, and then goes to the doctor, and then some lunatic district attorney says, well, I'm going to bring charges against that doctor. And that will probably last about as long as it takes to get in front of the grand jury. And the grand jury is going to look at this and say, we've had friends who've had ectopic pregnancies. We're not going to charge a doctor with a crime for that. But even if you imagine it going to trial, the first person they're going to put on the stand, if it actually got through indictment and to trial and everything else, would be a medical expert who said, yeah, ectopic pregnancies happen. And when they do, you treat the woman. And no, it's not a deliberate attempt to end the life. Well, I mean, isn't that going to shortchange any of those fear-mongering scenarios?
I certainly hope so, because this isn't actually a controversial issue. There's agreement across the medical community for ectopic pregnancies that, sadly, there is nothing that can be done to save the life of a tiny little baby that's implanted in the fallopian tube. A child can't grow outside of the uterus. And 90% of ectopic pregnancies, that baby is implanted in the fallopian tube. On rare occasions, every now and then, it might happen in the ovary or somewhere else in the woman's body. But this isn't a controversial thing. This isn't up for debate. These are facts of the medical community. So you're absolutely right. If there ever was a bizarre situation where somehow this wound up in a courtroom, right away, the medical community would be on both sides, whether they're pro-life or pro-choice, on both sides, they're going to say 100%, this procedure was necessary to save the life of the woman, and nothing could be done to save the life of that child.
You know, I think what's really bothering the pro-abortion crowd, I refuse to call them pro-choice, is that, you know, they always say, well, what if a woman's, you know, what if a child is raped and has this pregnancy? I said, well, the baby did nothing wrong. Well, but you can't make her have that child. And I said, well, one of the young ladies I interviewed who was running for Senate in Pennsylvania was the daughter of a woman who was pregnant at, I believe it was 11, it might have been 12. And that, you know, that young lady, that girl, went ahead and had the baby, and probably at some risk to herself. But her daughter grew up to be a military veteran, a business owner, the wife, mother of, I think, three, and ran for the U.S. Senate. I said, would you wish that they had just extinguished her way back when? And I think that's what they want. Kathy Barnett, by the way, if you want to look her up.
Yeah. Oh yeah, she's wonderful. I'm familiar with Kathy's work. She's amazing. You know, I recently spoke with a woman on the Daily Signal podcast. Our interview is actually airing tomorrow morning on the Daily Signal podcast. Her name is Reverend Eve Nunez, and she was raped when she was 14 years old, and she was raised in a Jewish home. She says she was raised to know that everyone deserved a chance at life. So she decided as a 14-year-old girl that even as she was receiving pressure from members in her family to have an abortion, she decided, no, everyone deserves a chance at life. I'm going to have this baby. So 50 years ago, she had her son. She was 15 years old when that child was born. And, you know, today she has a great relationship with her son, and she's been a voice for life across the pro-life movement now for decades and is helping women who face similar situations. So you're absolutely right. So powerful to hear those stories where good comes out of such tragedy.
You've got to check out the Daily Signal podcast. One of its hosts is Virginia Allen. Virginia, it's a pleasure. I'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. And yes, I was gone for a few days last week because, well, I wanted to take the family on a little vacation. So my granddaughter, my wife, and some members of our family went on a little bit of a vacation, just a driving vacation. A lot of fun. Found a great theme park in northern Idaho that is just as good as Disneyland, and I would argue better, because it doesn't come with all the woke nonsense that you get out of Disneyland. So just saying that. It's called Silverwood. I've got no other involvement in the park other than that my granddaughter had one heck of a great time, and it was easily accessible to us. So in any case, not for free. We paid full rate. I always do. 866 Hey Lars is the number to call. And as we say, naysayers always go to the head of the line. So D goes first. D, welcome to the program. And what do you and I disagree about to make you a naysayer?
Well, welcome back. Silverwood is a great place. I loved it. And thank you for taking my call. Sure. I wanted to talk about Senator Warren today.
Elizabeth Warren, yeah.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago you told your listeners that she lied. I was wondering if she was lying about her bloodline, if she was lying about getting the DNA test, if she was lying about the professional that took the test, or if she was lying about the $1 million that Trump promised to the charity of her choice if she got tested.
She lied about being a Native American. An Indian. Most of the friends I've had who are Native American don't call themselves Native American. They call themselves Indian, but not East Indian, but American Indians. And she lied about that. And she did it for her own benefit because it helped her secure positions in a university that she likely would not have secured any other way. And the university was proud to brag about her Native American heritage, if you prefer that term. It would be as though if I said, why, I'm a Pulitzer Prize winner. It's not true because I'm not a Pulitzer Prize winner. But if I said that and then the radio stations that I worked for said, why, Lars is a Pulitzer Prize winner. If it's to your benefit and you tell people something is true and it's not true. And then when you're questioned about it, you say, well, it's just that's the way I remember the stories. Well, hold on a second. You run around saying... She didn't. She proved that she was one out of 1,024th. What's that?
If you can prove that you're a Pulitzer Prize winner,
But she didn't prove anything.
She didn't say that she was Native American or Indian. She said that she was 14%, And the test proved that she was within five to
but
seven generations.
But she was not 14%. It was one out of 1,024. And by the way, if you dig in, and we did a couple of years ago when she did this, I don't know why it's still a fresh issue for you, but when she did this, they said, well, this showed that you had some blood, some DNA in you that came from either Central or South America, could have been the United States as well. It didn't even show that she was somebody who would have been considered a tribal member in any way, shape, or form.
Well,
so
no,
she proved
not
nothing.
A tribal member, there you can't. You don't become a tribal member by.
Well, okay, that she didn't have the DNA to say. For instance, I mean, I've done 23andMe.
Five to seven generations is pretty good.
No, but she didn't. What she proved was, if you go back far enough, and this is true of almost anybody, I can find DNA in.
Yes.
Do you want me to let me finish? I can show DNA in my background that it takes me all the way back to Europe, takes me back to Ireland, takes me back to Sweden. But if I walked around saying I'm Swedish, well, no, you're not. You're an American. And here's the difference, D. If you get a benefit out of claiming that you are. I mean, there have been plenty of fakes that we've seen in recent years. Rachel Dolezal from Spokane claimed that she was black. She wasn't black, but she claimed that. It got her a job. It got her pay as I think she was the head of the local NAACP chapter, and she wasn't anything of the kind. So when you lie to get yourself a financial benefit, I consider that a particularly egregious lie. And then when you are a representative... Go ahead.
Warren never said that she was Native American. She said that she had Native American in her DNA.
Well, I don't actually I'll go back and I'll take a look at what she said when she portrayed herself as being Native American. I can tell you this. When I think it was Harvard bragged about her being on the faculty and that she was the first Native American person on the faculty, that's not saying I've got it in my DNA.
Yeah.
Like if I said I've got some Irish in my DNA, if you've got a couple of percentage points, but if you said I'm half Irish or I can call myself Irish, there's a big difference. And again, you're ignoring why did she do it? Why would she want to make that claim? Because it had both a political and a financial.
And look at that claim.
Okay, but I'll be glad to look it up, but at the time, she portrayed herself as being Native American, and she allowed other people to portray her that way, and it had both a political benefit for her as a candidate. As you can imagine, in this day and age when everybody's concerned about, you know, that people of color are treated by a different standard than white people, and that white people under critical race theory are viewed as evil colonialists and oppressors, and people of color are viewed as the victims of those oppressors, that for anybody, especially from the Democrat Party side of the aisle, to say, I am a person of color, it insulates you from a whole lot of criticism. It allows you to say things about yourself and claim things about yourself. It's nothing different than lying on your resume. I mean, for example, I do not have a college. Go ahead.
I was going to say I understand totally the political benefit of her saying it, but I also, you can't just say that she's a bald-faced liar when she can still prove what
well,
she said.
Needs my,
I can't
see,
remember
the thing,
exactly
D,
what she
D,
said, and I'll go back and look at it.
D, I'll tell you what. From my point of view, I can call her a bald-faced liar because I think if you lie about anything about your personal background and you do it for your own benefit, then that is an egregious kind of lie to tell. I mean, if you said I'm a really good, I'm really good at power tools. You know, I can cut a board, but you know, really good means well, okay, in your opinion. But when you lie about parts of your background to make people, you know, if for example, what I was going to use as an example is people say, well, did you attend the University of Oregon? I said, yeah, I did. Did you get a degree? No, I didn't. And I'm always careful to point that out because I could allow people to believe I went to the U of O. That usually means you graduated from that college. But if you, mm-hmm. but you could allow people to believe that you could go take one class at a university. I could go take one class at say, I'm trying to think of a college I admire, Hillsdale, right? Hillsdale College is a very admirable college, unlike a lot of them that are liberal indoctrination factories. But if I allowed people to believe that I graduated from that college because I took one class there, you say, well, I attended Harvard, or I attended Yale, or I attended Stanford. And they said, did you attend there? And I said, well, I took one class. It was a two-credit class.
Well, that's
you
why,
say, well, that doesn't mean – that means you would
be able to get away with it.
What's that?
Well, that's why organizations such as Fox News and CNN, for that matter, get away with it, is because they don't
get away
know
with
a
what?
Lie. But they, by well, getting away with telling a truth, because they're not telling a lie, but they still get their
don't
viewers.
Don't expect me to defend Fox, because I think Fox is a thoroughly corrupted organization right now. So I'm not a fan of Fox. But all I'm saying is that if I told you why I attended Harvard, and it made it sound like I could let you believe, well, he's a Harvard graduate. And I say, well, I never said I was a Harvard graduate. I said I attended there. That's the kind of lie that I think is especially sneaky. And I think Elizabeth Warren is especially sneaky. In any case, thanks for the call. Good naysayer call. Back in a moment. It's a Monday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show, expecting to hear from Joe Biden on they say they've killed Ayman al-Zawahiri. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Well, Americans are now looking at huge inflation numbers, and despite what Joe Biden claims, we're headed into or already in a recession. So is the best possible move to hire almost 90,000 additional IRS agents? You know, we only have 1,000 billionaires. We could probably assign 90 of them to each 90 IRS agents for every billionaire, if that's really what he's after, which I think is the official story. We're not after the average person. We're after the very, very rich. Grover Norquist joins me now, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Hey, Grover, how are you doing?
I'm doing reasonably well. The economy, not so much.
Yeah, no kidding. In fact, before we get into the IRS agents, what's your take on the fact that the White House is now trying to redefine what a recession is and say, no, no, don't believe the numbers. It's actually not a recession.
At one hand, you sort of wonder what they're thinking, but it's like a child with a broken vase on the ground and he tells you he didn't do it. what else is he supposed to say, right? You know, there's just nothing else to say, because on inflation, he created the inflation by spending $2 trillion to no effect, to zero effect, didn't increase growth, didn't increase the number of people employed compared to what was going to happen without any $2 trillion. That's a lot of money to waste, to have nothing to show for it except inflation. Now you have a recession because of the threats of all the regulations they're putting out, the powers given to the labor union bosses and the trial lawyers. It's a mess. And anything you can do to say, oh, look, a puppy, and distract the press and hopefully the American people, he's just stuck. He's reduced to that. What would we have him say, right?
Grover, an honest answer to your question?
Yeah,
Clinton headed into the early 90s, having been elected, and said, we're going to do this. And then 2 years in, when it was clear that this was not working, they did a course correction. They said, well, this isn't working. We'll do a course correction. We'll do business with the Republicans. Now, the voters sent them a little bit of a message in the midterm elections, too. But they said, we're going to, you know, course correct on this. And I thought, well, that was at least the sensible thing to do. I see no course correction coming from the Biden administration.
I agree with you, and it's not going to happen. What may happen is if they lose the House and the Senate in November, there'll be a course correction because they can't, the bleeding stops. They can't pass new laws. They can't raise taxes again. They're going to have to need the Congress to do a budget, and they're not going to agree to the kind of levels of spending that Biden wants. So he can either get up and go, yes, I'm part of this new approach, as Clinton did, or he can be dragged along behind the car, you know, just okay, and left, you know, not in charge. But I don't think that Biden is running things. I think there are, in effect, 10 interest groups sitting around a table, the labor unions, the trial lawyers, the big city political machines, the radical environmentalists, all these various groups, and they all have a veto on what happens. And so Biden doesn't get to get up in the morning and say, I think I'll do this. He has to go, mother, may I, to the very interest groups that put him in power, or rather put him in a chair. They took the power. And they're going to just keep going because they have to feed their political machine. They have to keep trying to raise taxes. There's no compromising for them is called losing.
Except that, Grover, I don't know. I've never worked in the government, and I never planned to have a job in the government. I can't even imagine the circumstances. But if you're actually there to say, I want to try and get something done, when you become the losing side, you've got the president's signature, but no bill gets to his desk. Isn't that the time where you sit down and say, okay, maybe we can do some horse trading. We'd like some of this. You'd like some of that. And you get some deals done. Isn't that what's supposed to happen on between Capitol Hill and the White House in a regular government that actually operates sanely?
Well, it might. The problem is the Venn diagram, the overlap between what the Republicans want and the Democrats want is very small, if not missing. The Democrats want higher taxes. The Republicans want lower taxes. The Democrats want higher spending. The Republicans largely want less spending. The Democrats want labor unions to have more power over workers, and the Republicans want people to be independent contractors and have less power over workers, the unions. So it's not like they're trying to do the same thing. They're trying to do the opposite thing from each other. So the Venn diagram, there are little things you can do. We got some criminal justice reform done in the Trump administration, and the Democrats actually helped on some of that. But when the two parties actually largely stand for something, they have a set of principles, it means they're operating in different directions. Bipartisanship, the old kind of bipartisanship is, I'd like to get some money and give it to my friends, and you'd like to get some money and give it to your friends. Let's both go out and mug the taxpayers, and we all give money to our friends. We call that a compromise. We call that bipartisan.
Let's not do that.
I'm glad that.
I'd rather have gridlock.
It's dead.
I'd rather have gridlock.
Yep.
And by the way, while they're in gridlock, take a whole bunch of what they've already done from the left side of the aisle and run it past the courts and get it struck down by the courts. I think that's perfectly acceptable.
Gridlock in Washington is now fine for Republicans and conservatives because the courts have 20 years of undoing bad precedent that the left put in that didn't come from the Constitution. And the states, where there are 30 Republican states where the Republicans have both houses of the legislature, are doing school choice. They're phasing out their income taxes. And that keeps moving us in the right direction. Even the Democrat states are at some point going to have to stop the high tax rates that drive people out of their states, the government monopoly schools that people don't want to be forced into anymore. So we're winning at the state and local level because our ideas work and can go state to state. Theirs can't. And we're winning at the court level because the Supreme Court has a number of people who've read the Constitution all the way through.
Imagine that. Grover Norquist with us from Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, it's a pleasure as always. By the way, I got a little advice for you. There are so many more things to do during this summer. You want to free up as much time as possible. So if you're a business owner like me, the last thing you want to do is sort through lots and lots of resumes when you could be having a barbecue or even catching up on yard work. That's why you need ZipRecruiter to find great candidates. They do the work for you. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Lars. Use that technology to find the right candidates for all your jobs. ZipRecruiter has a whole suite of tools. That's why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. No wonder ZipRecruiter is #1 rated based on G2 satisfaction ratings as of January 1. Soak up all that summer has to offer and let ZipRecruiter do the work. Ready for the website? ZipRecruiter.com/Lars. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Lars. Try it for free. ZipRecruiter.com/Lars. The smartest way to hire. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to a Monday. Glad to have you with me and glad to take your phone calls and your emails. But I am just about beside myself at this point. There is something the Biden administration has just dropped, and it is a bombshell. But you have to know what to listen for. I'm going to play a soundbite for you in just a moment. But first, welcome to the show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our Twitter poll. I'll get into that just a little bit later. You'll find it two places, at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. If you don't like Twitter, you can find it elsewhere as well. I told you that Joe Biden is owned lock, stock, and barrel by his Chinese communist masters in Beijing. Now, I know that some of you may have put that aside and said, well, okay, Lars, you say crazy stuff all the time. This guy has sold out to China, and the proof of it is in what his State Department spokesman said today. The guy's name is John Kirby. He speaks for the Joe Biden State Department, and this came down literally just minutes ago. Take a listen.
Repeatedly said that we oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo from either side. We have said that we do not support Taiwan independence, and we have said that we expect cross-strait differences to be resolved by peaceful means.
Now, hold on. We do not support Taiwan independence. You say, big deal, Lars. What does that mean? Let me sketch this out for you, but first I have to admit that I have a dog in the fight. And by the way, there's a major primary election tomorrow in Washington State. I'm a Washington State voter, so I have a dog in the fight. But Joe Biden has been sold out to China. And this is proof of it. Let me tell you why. I have a dog in the fight. I was born in China. My parents were both in the United States Navy. Mom had done her Navy service and was out. My dad was still doing his 20 years. So I was born in what they then called Formosa. It is an independent country. Now, if you say, well, Lars, you're saying that, but how do we know it's an independent country? Well, here's how we know. The United States government approves weapons sales to Taiwan. You say, okay, people buy weapons all the time. Who are they protecting themselves from? Primarily, Taiwan is protecting itself from mainland China. Now, one of two things is possible. If you're selling weapons to Taiwan to defend itself against mainland China, which has for decades threatened to take Taiwan back by force. They threaten missiles. In fact, Nancy Pelosi is supposed to go there. We got confirmation today she will be going to Taiwan. And you say, well, what's wrong with that? They're one of our allies. Yes, they're a great ally. They're a freedom-loving country. They're a capitalist country. They're a very tiny country, about 13,000 square miles, but they're one of the most productive countries on earth. You say, why would it be a problem to sell weapons to Taiwan? Well, because one of two things is true. If the United States government approves the sale of weapons to Taiwan, as we have for decades, to protect themselves against China, that's effectively saying they're a separate country. Okay? If, on the other hand, what John Kirby just said, we do not support Taiwan's independence. Now, I'll play the soundbite in a moment so you can hear it again to make sure I wasn't hearing something that wasn't there. If you're saying Taiwan is not independent and we do not support the independence of Taiwan, that's what the Chi-Com jerks in Beijing want Joe Biden to say. That's probably why they paid his coked up, prostitute-loving son, Hunter Biden, so much money, tens of millions of dollars, to buy influence with Joe Biden. And that bought influence is paying dividends right now because Joe Biden's State Department just said, we don't support Taiwan's independence. Well, then who are you selling the weapons to? If Taiwan is really part of mainland China, as the commies in Beijing insist it is, they say that's part of our country. That is not its own country. That is part of our country. That is the position of Beijing. If that's true, then all these decades that we've been selling weapons to the Taiwanese, and believe me, we're not giving it to them like we are with Joe's buddies in Ukraine. We're giving them tens of billions of dollars. The Taiwanese are so productive, they buy their weapons, but they need to do it with the permission of the U.S. government. If we're selling weapons to Taiwan, but Taiwan is not independent of China in the view of the Biden administration, then that means we're selling some of our best weapons to mainland China. Now, you say, well, Lars, that doesn't make any sense either. We wouldn't be selling weapons to our enemies in China. Well, we might if we had a president who's bought off because of his son's dirty deals in Beijing. I mean, this guy got tens of millions of dollars And all he could sell was daddy's influence when Joe Biden was vice president. So again, it's one way or the other. You're either selling weapons to an independent country that you recognize as an independent country that needs to protect itself from the evil Chinese communists in Beijing and protect free China, Republic of China, Taiwan, which is, you know, it's Chinese, but it's not mainland Chinese. It's not communist Chinese. You're either selling weapons to an ally to protect themselves against the predations of mainland China, or you're selling weapons to mainland China. So, Joe, which one is it? Listen again so you don't think I heard something that wasn't there. But this is just from within the last couple of hours. The spokesman for Joe Biden's State Department, John Kirby, who says Taiwan is not an independent country. Listen.
Repeatedly said that we oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo from either side. We have said that we do not support Taiwan independence, and we have said that we expect cross-strait differences to be resolved by peaceful means.
By peaceful means. That means the Chi-Coms threaten Joe. Joe basically doesn't back up Taiwan, and Taiwan falls to the mainland communists. Now, that's probably where we're headed right now. I hate to say it, because when China literally said, if Nancy Pelosi flies into Taiwan this week on an American plane, a government plane, if that plane is protected by American fighter jets, the Chinese communists have said, we will shoot that plane down. Now, you know what I think is going to happen? I don't think the commies are going to shoot Nancy Pelosi down. I don't like Nancy Pelosi's politics. I don't like her personal behavior. I don't like her stock trading. But she is an American government official elected by her constituents. She may have fools for constituents, but she is an elected official. She deserves the support of the U.S. government. When a foreign power like China says, if you send one of your officials to your ally, Taiwan, we will shoot the plane out of the sky, they're testing Joe Biden. They're making sure that while they're pretty sure they've got him bought and paid for, they're pretty sure, but they want to make sure. So they say, tell you what, send Nancy over in a jet. We'll shoot the jet right out of the sky. And depending on what Joe does, and more importantly, what he does not do, they find out if they've actually got the fix in the White House that they paid all those millions of dollars for years ago. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment. We got to talk about Taiwan, though. As you may know, Nancy Pelosi, while it's not on her official schedule, we are led to believe, Reuters is reporting, she will be on her trip to Asia, will be visiting Taiwan. I have a dog in the fight. I was born there. I think a lot of that country, that is the Republic of China, the free China, the capitalist China, the self-determining China, as differentiated from the mainland, which was run by a bunch of communist thugs who don't treat their people very well at all. Big difference between the two countries. Now, you're never going to hear Joe Biden call them two countries. But today, as I introduce Kelly Vlahos, senior advisor at the Quincy Institute and editorial director of Responsible Statecraft. Kelly, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lars.
Kelly, have you heard what John Kirby had to say just a short time ago, the spokesman for Joe Biden's State Department?
No, I did not. I'm sorry. I'm remiss in that. So
that's
all.
No. I want to play the soundbite for you because I just about came out of my shoes. Dusty, would you mind playing that soundbite, please?
Repeatedly said that we oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo from either side. We have said that we do not support Taiwan independence, and we have said that we expect cross-strait differences to be resolved by peaceful means.
Now, hold on. We, meaning the Joe Biden administration, does not support Taiwan's independence. Taiwan is an ally. Taiwan is a country. And I understand we've played this little game for a few decades called the One China policy to keep the Chi-Coms happy. But this is the president of the United States, through his State Department, saying we don't support the independence of the country known as Taiwan. Kelly, that seems pretty stunning.
It's stunning, but that's our policy. So, I mean, it's been our policy since 1979, as you mentioned. So it's even greater, several decades. They've been, like you said, committed to an ambiguity, a strategic ambiguity when it comes to China. So we don't outwardly support the independence of Taiwan in our official declarations, but we support their human rights. We support trade. We support them having the freedom to speak out against China, but we don't support the independence in an official capacity. And I know that's frustrating for you and for others who think it's like absolutely an imperative to support the independence of this country from China. But that's how we've kept this thing from blowing up in the region for the last few decades. I think if you want to change it, you know, I think that Trump was probably going in that direction with his rhetoric, but even his administration didn't change that official policy.
Well, can I ask you a couple of questions that lead to, as the lawyers like to say, in aid of an objection? We approve weapons sales to Taiwan, right?
Right.
Okay. So we're selling weapons to Taiwan. Who would be the primary opponent that Taiwan would use those weapons against?
Well, I mean, if you look at the policy One China, but also the Taiwan Relations Act, it spells out that we are to give them, and we're committed to giving them weapons for their defense.
Against
so that they are
their
not
defense,
by,
but Kelly,
like,
they're
China.
Yeah, against China.
Right, but we don't commit to defending them if China attacks, and that's where the ambiguity comes in.
No, and
so
I get
that we have this deal with China that we're not going to say we will stand in for Taiwan with our massive, you know, military power, but we will give them the ability to deter any attack from China.
Isn't that supportive?
Frustrating, but
no, but Kelly, isn't that if you say I'm going to give you a gun and you use the gun to keep that person from telling you what to do, isn't that effectively supporting the independence of Taiwan? Because Taiwan can say to mainland China, when you threaten us, and they do all the time, they've done it for decades. They'll sometimes say, if you elect a certain person as president of Taiwan, we will hit you with missiles. Mainland China has done that for decades, and we give them weapons to fight back. But we say, but we don't officially recognize you as independent, but we're giving you the weapons to stay independent.
Right. That's how we keep things from blowing up. We're talking about a nuclear power here. So what they have put in place is an agreement, you know, that we won't push the issue with China so that we don't go into a direct confrontation with a nuclear power. But yet we will help Taiwan deter China from any aggressive attack on that country. So, you know, they call it strategic ambiguity. So we say we will defend. We say they have the right to defend themselves, but we don't spell out what we would do even if there was an attack. And so Biden goes out there a few months ago and he says to a reporter, yes, we will defend China and attack. And as you notice, everybody blew up. They're like, oh, what's he doing with the strategic ambiguity has been blown away. because it's all about the official declarations. Now, I know there are a number of people, whether it be former Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, who was in Taiwan a couple weeks ago, or former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who are saying, let's get rid of this strategic ambiguity. Let's go flat out. Say we defend their independence, we believe in it, and that we will stand in if they are attacked. Let's just be straight out honest about it. And there's a big debate right now about whether we should do that because, like I said, we don't want to get in a direct confrontation with a nuclear power.
I completely agree with that, and I think is Pelosi's visit a good idea then? Because this is the first House Speaker, it's the highest ranking U.S. official to go to Taiwan in a quarter century.
Right, and a lot of people are saying it's a bad idea. I mean, first of all, she doesn't, you know, she represents the Congress, good for her, but she's also flying there on an official Air Force airplane. So it's obvious she's in an official capacity representing the U.S. government. Every move she makes, every word that comes out of her mouth is an antagonistic you know, move towards China. And maybe a lot of people in your audience would be like, well, so what? I mean, they deserve it. Like you said, communist thugs. But if we want to keep the peace in the region and maybe at some point, you know, develop a diplomatic solution to Taiwan's independence issue, I think that might be better than just sort of escalating something to the point where China feels it does need to attack Taiwan and take it. And, you know, it's a chicken and egg thing. But let's just say that Nancy Pelosi's behavior is not exactly helping the situation in the context of a lot of other tensions that are occurring right now. This isn't happening in a vacuum. This isn't happening at a time when China feels like that we are sort of coming into their neighborhood and we're setting up flags and we're telling them what's going to happen. And they're responding by doing military exercises and, you know, throwing rhetoric and shade our way, you know. And so it's just escalating into a spiral that I...
Kelly Vallejos. Kelly, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. Hey, does the high price of CBD have you rationing or just doing without? You shouldn't have to live that way. Get the relief you need right now. Go to genericcbd.com. They sell premium CBD for less, a lot less. Here's an example. A leading brand of CBD salve costs about $50. At genericcbd.com, it's on sale, $19.95. The amazing CBD muscle and joint cream that I've been telling you about the last few weeks, you see similar cream selling for up to $80. And that's if you can find it. At genericcbd.com, it's in stock and on sale, $29.95. That's a $50 savings. They have incredible prices on all their CBD products, but you're not going to find them in any store, at least not yet. You can only get them at genericcbd.com. Give them a try. You might be shocked at how much money you save. That's genericcbd.com, your number one source for generic CBD. Genericcbd.com. These products and statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or illness. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And of course, it is an election year, even though we really won't get rolling in earnest until after Labor Day. But obviously, a lot of people are paying a lot of attention to politics right now. And you're seeing various different efforts. We talked earlier about Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan, which is less, I think, about projecting American power than it is about protecting Nancy Pelosi from her constituents in San Francisco, many of whom are Asian Americans. And then you look at other efforts like Joe Biden, who we just learned is going to make some kind of statement to the nation tonight because he claims that he has hit an Al-Qaeda target of some significance. We'll find out more about that a bit later. Phil Kirpin joins me now. He's the president of American Commitment. I want to get Phil's take on where politics is taking policy as all these folks try to either preserve their political future or maybe even improve their situation. Phil, how are you?
I'm pretty good, Lars. How are you?
Not too bad. So tell me about this. You write that there are a lot of ingredients in the 2010 Republican electoral landslide, but the most significant was raiding hundreds of billions of dollars from Medicare to pay for Obamacare. The Democrats gave the Medicare Cuts Club that they had used to beat the Republicans over the head for decades to their opponents, who then hammered away at them. Now, 12 years later, they may be trying to do the very same thing again. Can you describe what they're up to?
Yeah, well, there are two big sources of funding for this big mansion spending bill. One of them is the business tax. The other one is cutting Medicare prescription drug spending. And they keep phrasing it, you know, with positive spin. They're calling it negotiation. They're calling it pricing reform. They've got all these different euphemisms for it. But fundamentally, what they're doing is taking almost $300 billion out of Medicare prescription drug spending to spend it on, you know, Green New Deal subsidies to wind and solar and Obamacare subsidies to the big insurance companies. And so it's largely a replay of what they did in 2010 when they used Medicare as a piggy bank. And the their hopes, their political hopes, are pinned on this idea that they can convince seniors that somehow Medicare spending $300 billion less on prescription drugs will not hurt them. And I don't think most people believe that. I mean, most people have too much common sense to think you're going to get the same number of drugs, the same new drugs, the same access to drugs if you siphon $300 billion out of the Medicare prescription drug program.
But they've got to find a win somewhere. And so far, Build Back Broke and some of these ideas aren't going anywhere. So they're going to just sort of raid the cupboard and say, we'll take the money out of here, but no, it's not going to hurt grandma. I mean, who buys that kind of argument?
Well, the media. The media does. You know, I've already been politifacted. They said it was false when I said that you can't take $300 billion out of Medicare without hurting seniors. They said, totally false. I was like, okay, guys.
How do they figure it's false? No, but Phil, are they saying, oh, we just found out we can get a smoking good deal on all the usual pharmaceuticals that either keep people alive or make their lives better, and if we just don't spend the money, we'll still get the same result for all those Americans who are on Medicare?
They've got a very dirty trick, because it is a price control. It is the government just forcibly lowering prices, taking the money out to spend on something else. But instead of just saying the Secretary of HHS will set the price, what they do is they say the Secretary of HHS will negotiate with the manufacturer, and if the manufacturer doesn't like the price that the Secretary wants, if they can't come to an agreement in the negotiation, they'll be taxed 95% of their total gross sales of that product, and the 95% excise tax cannot be deducted for corporate income tax purposes. In other words, they'll tax you out of business if you don't go along with the price that the Secretary wants. And then you might say, okay, well, what's the point of having this charade, of having this exercise of a fake negotiation where a company has no choice but to go along with it, or else they get hammered, you know, into oblivion by this tax? And the whole point of it is to create this fake political talking point to say, oh, we're just doing a negotiation. It's not a fraud. It's a negotiation.
Well, it's negotiating.
And then the word negotiation polls at like 80%. People are like, oh, that's great.
Phil, I could buy your house for $10 if I could negotiate with a gun to your temple. I mean, that's what
correct.
It sounds like.
Which is what this is. So they're really just forcibly taking the money out of Medicare prescription drug spending. And, you know, you're going to get a lot fewer new drugs as a consequence of that. It's going to come directly out of that industry, which, you know, a lot of people hate that industry right now for some pretty good reasons. So they're a good political punching bag. But the fact is, if you take that much money out of Medicare prescription drug spending, you're going to have a lot less new drugs. And in particular, they've carved out the biotech drugs in this. And so it's traditional small molecule drugs, which means you're really what you're going to hit the hardest in terms of the research funding from this is Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, other diseases of the brain, because the biotech drugs, they typically are too large to cross the blood-brain barrier. And so this is really going to be a major setback for those in particular. So you would assume the seniors groups have got to be totally against this, and they're not. They're actually for it. AARP is out there leading the charge in favor of this because, as we've talked about before on your show, Lars, they get $750 million every single year from UnitedHealthcare, and UnitedHealthcare's got their hand out for the Obamacare subsidies that this is funding in the bill.
Well, see, Phil, I've got a little dog in the fight because I've been all about AMAC, which is a different group than AARP. So I'll admit I have a dog in the fight. But one of the reasons I've hated AARP, and I despise that group, is that they're one of the groups that pushed Obamacare across the finish line. You know, they helped to get it passed.
Because
they made money on it, right?
Yep. Look, so, I mean, just the numbers are so staggering. $750 million every year they make from UnitedHealth. I mean, it's like triple what they make in membership.
Well, if you get that amount of scratch from any one customer, if you think about a business that, like you said, they make more money from UnitedHealthcare than they do from their own members. So do they necessarily have to? No, they advocate for whoever's money is the greenest, right?
Yeah, so it's remarkable. They've been doing like press conferences every day demanding that this bill be passed that directly siphons money out of Medicare prescription drug spending, nearly $300 billion. I mean, seniors groups should be going nuts about this. I think it's going to be really, really harmful. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, price controls always cause shortages, right? But when the price control is of gasoline or whatever, people see the shortage, they see the long line, they're angry about it. When the price control causes some Alzheimer's drug or some Parkinson's drug not to exist, people don't even know what could have been, so they don't even know that they should be angry. That's why it's so dangerous, because once we go down this path, this is going to be their go-to piggy bank for everything they want. They're just going to ratchet down the price controls, expand them to more and more drugs, and people won't really know what we've lost out on.
Well, isn't there a reason that the United States is still on the cutting edge for a lot of the drug research? Because The European countries have done exactly this. They go to the big drug companies and say, sell to us at this price or you won't sell at all. And so many of them have said, fine, then we won't. What happens when American drug companies just pull up stakes and say, we're going somewhere else? I mean, because research and production can be done almost anywhere on the planet, can't it? That's Phil Kirpin, the president of American Commitment. We'll be back in a moment. I've got a little tool for you. Think about this. I'm a small business owner, but even if you're not, if you've been to the grocery store or the hardware store, you know that America has major supply chain issues. In times like this, businesses that succeed, they're the ones that are forward-thinking. And one of the best ways to stay ahead of the curve is use technology your customers use every single day. And that's where Podium comes into play. Podium gives your business the tools to compete with the convenience offered by bigger businesses, even huge companies like Amazon. Podium lets you communicate with your customers via text, something most people do dozens of times every day. Podium is just so convenient, and it works for basically any business, plumbing to healthcare or even IT. Podium helps customers communicate their needs, pay their bills, get their receipts, and a lot more. One jeweler sold a $5,000 ring through his website, coordinated curbside pickup via text messages, all of it through Podium. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/Larson. That's podium.com/Larson. Podium, let's grow. I'll be glad to get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to jump into the conversation, I'll get to phone calls here in just a moment. Vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Should the schools that you send your kids to and that you pay for, I got to remind you of that, you and the rest of the community pay for those public schools, should those schools secretly vaccinate your kids? The Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest school district in America. A mother says her 13-year-old son was bribed to receive a COVID-19 vaccination at school without mom's consent. Maribel Duarte, who is suing the LAUSD, held the press conference a couple of days ago with her attorney to complain about the side effects. And by the way, I know that some of you are vaccinated, some are not. Can you imagine this? Have you noticed how many young, healthy athletes have been just simply dropping dead? And of course, they are vaccinated. And you say, well, couldn't be the vaccine, could it? Look, we've been detailing this all the way back to the middle of last year, when we told you about otherwise healthy people who were finally bullied or pressured into taking the vaccine, and then once they got the vaccine, just dropping dead from cardiomyopathy and other kinds of ailments. Well, Duarte says, this is painful for me because my son's health is not good. He's lacking the rest. He doesn't sleep well. He doesn't exercise the way he did. He's not normal to me. Duarte says her son has had bleeding disorders and asthma since he was a child. Doctors recommended against him getting the COVID-19 vaccine. She said her son's condition got worse after he got the vaccine. He got breathing difficulties and other symptoms like depression and anxiety. And all of this happened without the school's initial consent. California state law prohibits minors between the ages of 12 and 17 from getting vaccinations other than those required by law without the consent of a parent or a guardian. The 13-year-old attends Barack Obama Global Preparatory Academy, which is under the jurisdiction of the LA Unified School District. So now mom is suing. Now, can you imagine what would happen? And before you say right off the bat, well, I know my kids haven't been vaccinated. Have you actually sat down and talked to them and said, did the school talk you into doing this without my consent, without dad's consent or mom's consent or both? Find out, because if the school talked your kid into getting the vaccination, they also realized the potential hazard of letting mom and dad know what was going on. And where, I just wonder, where do you find people who work at a government-operated school, a public school, and take a government paycheck, who think they have authority that can supersede the authority of parents to make medical decisions, life-changing medical decisions for their kids? Let's go to Dave. Hey, Dave, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Earlier, you were talking with somebody about windmills. I wanted to add a different perspective.
Sure. The gentleman, just for everybody else who might not have heard that, the gentleman called and said, why do I see some of these electricity generating windmills and they're not turning? And the two things I know of are, one, Most of the windmills are engineered for a 9 mile an hour sustained wind speed. So if you're not at 9, many of the windmills don't operate below a 9 mile an hour sustained speed. The second would be if there's a marketplace for the power, because power is generated a lot of different ways, and it may be that the windmill power is more expensive or has other questions. But I think the primary reason is there ain't enough wind. But what's your perspective?
Well, there's a YouTube video, or on the homepage of cctruth.org, there's a link called How to Ruin an Electric Grid in 3 Easy Steps. Not sure if you've ever seen it, Joe.
I have not. Why don't you describe it for the audience, because most of them probably haven't seen it either.
Joe Nova, who lives with her husband and child down in Australia, describes how Australia already tried to do what the UN wanted to do. They blew up their coal-fired power plants, put in solar panels on everybody's homes and all this free power, you know, in windmills and stuff. And all they had was rolling blackouts.
Yep.
And the
yep.
people in the country, they ended up buying diesel generators because they couldn't handle the grid switching, and that negated all their effects anyway.
And that's the reason. But you don't have a – well, Dave, I'm with you, because windmills could contribute to a power system, but when they're seen by the folks in charge, and Joe Biden and his Democrat friends in the Congress – want to have us do the Green New Deal, where we get rid of fossil-fueled electricity. Well, whether you like it or not, fossil-fueled electricity is almost 60% of the entire grid, and wind and solar are about 7 or 8%. So if you say, we're going to replace the stuff that produces 60% of our electricity with something that's only generating 6 or 7 or 8% of our electricity, and it's a source of power, in the case of solar panels, that can't generate power two-thirds of the day because it's
right.
dark. And, you know, so you generally get an average of 8 hours a day. That's January through December, because obviously in the summer you get more sun and in the wintertime you get less, but the average is about 8 hours a day. So you've got an energy source that delivers one-third of the day, and then the wind, strangely enough, the wind blows about one-third of the day. I mean, it may blow more in some parts of the world or some parts of America and less in other parts, but it's generally, it blows about one-third of the day. So how do you supply a modern country like ours with electricity with two new sources that only generate power one-third of the time? Dave, thanks for the call. Let's go to Will, who's a naysayer. Hey, Will, since we're close to the break, we've got a couple of minutes. What do you and I disagree about?
Yeah, the last segment with Joe Kent, you spent the entire time worrying about people might not know that Trump didn't pick Joe Kent. Why not worry about, like...
No, he did pick Joe Kent.
Yeah, right. Why does that even matter? Shouldn't, like the views and the ideas that, you know, someone has is more important than loyalty?
We've talked with Joe Kent about his views and ideas on, I don't know, a couple of dozen different subjects, but... In many cases, people will say, well, what kind of Republican is he? Well, he got Donald Trump's endorsement. That speaks
right.
volumes.
Why care
right?
about that? What, Trump's not even in office anymore. Who cares?
Who would you say is the single most powerful political figure in America today?
I would say probably on Republican side or just in general?
Just in general. Overall, who's the single most powerful political voice in America?
I would say Trump, but he's going to lose to DeSantis. So.
No, but you just answered the question then, Will. If you say
no,
whether he's in office or has a title or draws a paycheck, if he is the single most powerful political voice in the country, and then a candidate is running for office and gets his endorsement, it's got to mean a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course it does, and I think it's kind of gross. I mean, you used to make fun of
people. Why is it gross?
Worship. Used to make fun of people that, like Obama, didn't want to criticize him, and now here you are, like.
Oh, I don't worship Donald Trump, and I certainly don't worship B. Hussein Obama, but I don't worship Trump. I really think he does a great job, and I think a lot of people admire him.